So from about 500 BC to through the first millennium CE, there was a growth of sectarian worship of particular gods, particular deities, and sacrifice, yajna, homa, gave way to devotion, bhakti, and devotion worship, puja. So you get a shift from sacrificial worship amongst the Brahmins to devotional worship based on puja. Performing puja became a way of expressing love or devotion, bhakti, to a deity in some form. And you have bhakti, or devotion to a personal god or goddess, Bhagavan or Bhagavati. Bhagavat or Bhagavati. So during this period you get this shift from sacrificial religion to bhakti and an emphasis on devotional worship. Now there's some various historical developments occurred during this period. The great Brahmanical tradition of Vedic social values, ritual forms and Sanskrit learning comes to absorb local traditions of ritual and mythology. So in the south you get a god called Murukan, who becomes identified with Skanda. Skanda was Shiva's son. And you get Krishna becomes identified with Vishnu in a complex process. Bhandarkar, in his book Vaishnavism, Shaivism and Minor Religious Cults, I think he calls it, describes this process quite well, I think, with regard to Krishna. Krishna gets identified with Vasudeva. Vasudeva, Krishna, Narayana and Vishnu were probably independent deities that became merged together through the course of history. So Krishna, probably a local culture hero, who becomes identified in the course of time with Vishnu, and of course becomes a great central figure of the Bhagavad Gita and later texts, particularly Krishna devotional literature, the Bhagavata Purana and so on. The Bhagavata Purana, probably one of the most important texts in India, in Hinduism. So these regional traditions, which were perhaps originally expressed in vernacular languages, like Tamil, Marathi, whatever, become universalized through a process of Sanskritization, what's been called Sanskritization. So you get local traditions being absorbed into the Brahmanical tradition. The Brahmanical tradition is expressed through the medium of Sanskrit. Local traditions are in local languages, but they can get absorbed into this great Brahmanical Vedic sort of tradition going through history. So while there wasn't a single political system, although the Guptas were very important in their patronage of the Brahmins and support of particular cults, Sanskrit learning did provide a unified culture to a large extent. And Sheldon Pollock has called this the Sanskrit Cosmopolis. And there's a wonderful book he's written called The Language of the Gods in the World of Men, which came out about 2 years ago, which describes this medieval Sanskrit cosmopolis, which was a unifying cultural force, really. So a bit like medieval Europe with Latin, I suppose. So you get different kingdoms, but you have a shared culture and a transaction of people across political borders who shared this common Sanskrit cosmopolis, who shared this common tradition of Sanskrit learning.
What's his name?
Sheldon Pollock, P-O-L-L-O-C-K.
What books are associated with Sanskritization?
Oh, we'll have a look at Sheldon Pollock's book. And there's Fritz Stahl wrote an article on Sanskritization. I'm afraid I can't remember the bibliographical details.
They talk about the absorption of deities.
Yeah.
And other deities.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's slightly contentious. Some people don't think that there was this process of Sanskritization, but there seems to be strong evidence for Sanskritization. And you can take various deities like Krishna, like Murukan, and trace their development from local traditions to pan-Hindu, pan-Indian traditions. And their identification with the great sort of tradition of Brahmanical learning. Now, alongside that absorption of local traditions into the mainstream, you have the transformation of the ascetic ideal as well. So it's assimilation into high caste householder ideology. So we get this with the Bhagavad Gita, for example. And also, the ascetic ideal gets assimilated at a lower level into low caste possession cults, as we'll see in a few weeks' time. And between these extremes, we have highly revered renouncer groups, such as the Dashanamis, who developed during the medieval period. So you've got the great Brahmanical tradition of learning, you've got local traditions becoming absorbed into this, and their status rising through developing and adopting Sanskrit, high status language. And this Sanskrit cosmopolis extended throughout South Asia and extended to Southeast Asia as well, and Suvarna, to Burma, what's now Burma, the Khmer regions. And the Khmer kings were very keen on importing Brahmins from India to legitimize their reign. So this is a very interesting process you get occurring there. Now, politically, as I mentioned last week, you have the rise of kingdoms, particularly segmentary states, what Stein has called segmentary states, or embedded hierarchies of power. And the Guptas are particularly important, who patronized groups of Brahmins and gave them land. Ronald Inden is very good on the medieval period as well. And here's a collection of his papers in which he talks about medieval hierarchies of kings in India. And it's in a volume just called His Collected Papers, edited by Dawood Ali, which came out last year. He also wrote with Dawood Ali and one other person, Querying the Medieval, which is also the interface between religious texts and kingship, and particularly with case studies from Kashmir. Now, there's no surviving historiography in South Asia. We don't know, with very few exceptions. There is some, but nothing of the kind that developed in Europe or in with the Greek, Arabic, and European traditions. So you just don't get that kind of historiography, or indeed China, which makes the dating of Sanskrit texts very difficult and has reinforced the tendency to construct India as an ahistorical, mythical, or irrational, or mystical entity, in contrast to the West, which is historical, scientific, and rational. And this construction of India as the West's irrational other has tended to hide strongly rationalist elements within the Indian tradition and within the history of Indic culture, such as the science of ritual, particularly the science of grammar. The linguistics is the science par excellence in ancient India. Architecture, maths, discovery of Pythagoras' theorem before Pythagoras, for example. Logic and philosophy. So Hinduism, those rationalistic elements tend to get perhaps downplayed. Partly because you have no historiography, or very little historiography. You do get some in Kashmir, which is of course on the edges of Indic mainstream Brahmanical tradition. Well, there may be historiography, somebody pointed out, but it's just lost. Well, that's possible as well, but certainly we have very little surviving historiography. We don't have an Indian Herodotus or anything like that. But nevertheless, Hinduism did produce elaborate mythical narratives in which there's no clear distinction between history, hagiography, and mythology. So, I mean, in the West, if you like, there's this clear distinction between rationality and myth, logos and mythos, and religion is put under the side of mythos from the rationalist perspective, from the perspective of logos. Now in India, that distinction is not made clearly. I mean, there are very strong rationalist elements, but the contrast is not made. I mean, this contrast sets the scene, really, I think, in the West for a lot of discourse. So logos is rational and scientific, mythos is irrational and emotional and mystical and so on. And from the perspective of logos, all of religion, including Christianity from the 18th century onwards gets put into the realm of mythos. Now that doesn't really happen in India. So you get mythological texts, and they're mixed up with history, what we would call history. Now there are two important groups of narrative traditions embodied in oral and written texts, namely the two epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and the Puranas. And this group of literature is collectively called Itihasa Purana. Now, in these texts, we see a concerns of the political life at the court, the concerns of the Brahmins and the concerns of ordinary people, along with descriptions of ritual and mythology. And the texts chart the rise of the great theistic traditions of India, focused on the god Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess Devi. So these three deities come to the fore in the early medieval period and following, and major traditions get associated with them. And some scholars think that you can't really speak of Hinduism, but you can speak of Vaishnava tradition, Shaiva tradition, and Shakta tradition as distinct religions, if you like, with their own groups of literature. Now, although the epics transcend particular cultic affiliations, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, there is nevertheless a case for saying that they are Vaishnava in orientation. The Ramayana and Mahabharata tend to be Vaishnava in orientation, as are many Puranas. And it's worth bearing in mind that the epics continue to hold sway over the popular imagination, and have in the recent past been used in a nationalist politicisation of Hinduism, particularly Rama. And you may know the story of Ayodhya, the way they built a mosque on the place where Rama was Rama was supposed to have been born. But we'll look at that in the last week, which was torn down by Hindu nationalists in 1992. So we'll look at that in the last week. Now, in contrast to the epics, the Puranas, which means ancient things, the stories from the ancient past, are a vast body of complex narratives which contain genealogies of deities and kings up to the Guptas. They contain cosmologies, codes of law, descriptions of ritual, and accounts of pilgrimage centres. So they're extremely rich resources for understanding the history of Hinduism. The bulk of this material contained in the Puranas was established during the Gupta rule, although amendments were made to the text in medieval times. And traditionally there were five topics covered in these texts. There's the creation of the universe, the destruction of the universe, genealogies of kings, the reign of 14 mythical beings called the Manus, and the history of the solar and lunar dynasties. So they're very much concerned with history in one sense, but it's a sort of mythologized history. And by creation, we mean the universe has no beginning in Hindu traditions. So we mean the reinvigoration of a static universe, which then becomes manifest and then goes into contraction again at the end of a long period of time. So creation and destruction, not ex nihilo, but from pre-existing substance. And the groups of Brahmins who came to control this kind of material and indeed construct it and compose it were called the Smartas, those who followed the Smritis, the smarter Brahmins. And the Smartas, the Brahmins who followed the Smritis, and in particular the Puranic religion, became known as the Smartas or Pauranikas. Smartas or Pauranikas, those who followed the Puranas.
What does this Smritis mean?
Say it again, sorry.
What does the, I guess...
No, it's the Smriti. The Smritis were there's two distinctions in Hindu scriptures. There's Shruti, which is the revealed scripture, and Smriti, which is secondary revelation or the remembered tradition. The Smritis particularly referred to the law books, the Manu Smriti, the Yajnavalkya Smriti. But by extension, it refers to the Puranas and the epics, and also the Puranas and the epics. So these Smartas were those who followed the Smritis, the smarter Brahmins, or the Puranikas. And they were especially concerned with domestic worship of five shrines. It's called the Panchayatana Puja. And these five deities were Vishnu, Shiva, Ganesh, Surya, and Devi. And in later worship, distinct deities come to the fore. So it's interesting that the early Puranas were more were less sectarian than the later Puranas. As the Puranic material develops, you get the particular deities coming to the fore. So the Vishnu Purana, Shiva Purana focus on particular deities and cycles of mythology. And the Puranas are also linked to place and temple cities. And we must understand the development of the texts in the political atmosphere of the collapse of the Gupta Empire and the rise of independent kingdoms. So the Guptas collapsed about 500 AD CE and the rise of these independent kingdoms after that. This is a terribly complicated history, as somebody said earlier. So in the 7th century, these kingdoms were the Chalukyas in the central and western Deccan, the Pallavas in the southeast. And from about 900 to 1200, these kingdoms are replaced by the Pandyas in the far south, the Cholas in the Tamil region, and the Rashtrakutas replacing the Chalukyas. And each of these kingdoms developed urban centres, and these centres became centres of those kingdoms. There's a very good sort of history, spotted history of India by Kulkar, called History of India. I think it's sometime as well, I think it's just Kulkar, which he wrote about 20 years ago now. But it's a very good K-U-L-K-E, just a history of India. It's available in most bookshops, and it's a really good, it's an engaging read, and it's a short summaries of these different kingdoms. So if you get completely lost in this history, that's a good place to sort of try and sort it out. But of particular importance are the Chola Empire. So if you only remember one of these kingdoms, remember the Cholas in the Tamil region who built great temples, really. So the cities became the centres of commerce of these kingdoms and administration, but also ritual centres with the temple at the hub of the town and the streets radiating out from there. So Chidambaram, if you ever been to Chidambaram, you've got the central temple, and it's like all the streets radiate out from it, like a sort of cartwheel or something. So it becomes the focus of the town. So the authority of the king was established through this Brahmanical legitimization in the temple. And from the 11th to the 13th centuries, we have very large temple complexes being built as centres of the regional kingdom. So at Puri, for example, in Orissa, you get a great temple, the Jagannath Temple, which is a centre of power for the king. And becomes a great centre for attracting commerce and as well as different religious affiliations. And the Nataraja temple in Chidambaram is another example, where you have an image of the dancing Shiva as a central icon. The Raja Rajeshwara temple in Tanjore, the Rajendra I. And of particular importance here are the gods Vishnu, Shiva and Devi, all of whom had their own Puranas and are well established and important temples. So you get these important temples, right, these massive temples rising up in medieval India. That become, well, there was a conference on this a few weeks ago, which become centres of political power, but also centres of religious power. So as today, churches and temples are places for networking and all the rest of it, but they're also places of devotion and worship. And these very large temples, patronised by the kings and built by the kings, funded by the kings, were partly to legitimise the power of the king, but also had these other functions of being centres of learning. For example, the Sri Rangam temple, where Ramanuja was the abbot, was a great centre of learning, as was Chidambaram, and still is today. So we have the rise of these traditions, these temple cities, which were ritual as well as administrative centres. And you get the three traditions, Shaivism, Vaishnavism and Shaktism, developing associated with different regional temples. The Devi tradition, the Shakta tradition, was less centralised, and you do have temples to the goddess, large regional temples in some places, like in Calcutta, the temple to Kali. But on the whole, the most important deities are Shiva and Vishnu, and particularly Shiva in the south. And most of the kings seem to have adopted Shaivism as the state religion, as it were, and were very keen on Shiva, perhaps because of his more martial qualities. And the Vaishnava traditions often seems to have patterned themselves on the Shaiva traditions, although later that seems to have been reversed somewhat, and Vaishnava traditions become more dominant, more important than the Shaiva ones, perhaps. Now, today I want to talk about the Shaiva traditions. Now, a Brahmin householder who worships Shiva with puja, using Vedic mantras and making offerings to orthodox forms of Shiva, i.e. the Shiva Linga, so within the orthoprax sphere of adherence to Varnashrama Dharma. So you have these worshippers of Shiva who are Brahmins, and they worship the Linga, what's called the phallic form of Shiva, the Shiva Linga, the aniconic form of Shiva, which is established in most of the temples in South India. And they adhere to the Veda, they're Vaidika, they're orthoprax, and they follow the Varnashrama Dharma, the Dharma with regard to your stage of life and caste or class. And this kind of follower, this orthodox, smarter follower of Shiva, was called a Maheshvara, that was the name that they called themselves. And they followed Puranic worship of Shiva. And that Puranic worship of Shiva can be contrasted with those who called themselves Shaivas, who had undergone a special initiation. So Maheshvara then followed the Puranic worship of Shiva. So as in the Shiva Purana, the Linga Purana, these were all Maheshvaras who followed that religion. And at death, through performing their correct rituals, a Maheshvara went to Shiva's heaven at the top of the world. So in these Puranic cosmologies, the world is an anda, the universe is a Ling. It's a bit like the giant cosmology, but they had a human body. So a Maheshvara, when he dies, you go up to the Shiva Loka, which is the world at the top of the universe. There's lots of other lokas, lots of other worlds, but the Shiva Loka is at the top. And that's, if you're a devotee, a Puranika devotee of Shiva, that's where you go. Now, these Maheshvara traditions, or the Puranic tradition, was contrasted with a Tantric tradition, which I'll be talking about in a second, which of the Shaivas as opposed to the Maheshvaras. So the Maheshvaras followed the Puranas and went to Shivaloka when they died. The Shaivas rejected this model and said, well, actually, they didn't reject it, they said, that's all very well, but actually we have a higher goal than that. We have a total liberation, which is beyond the Shivaloka. The Shivaloka is just another world. We transcend the Shivaloka in our practice. So the Shaivas then followed the teachings of Shiva, the Shiva Shasana, contained in the Shaiva scriptures, namely the Tantras. So the Shaivas then revered this group of texts called the Tantras. Now, the Puranic worship of Vishnu followed the same model. So instead of the Shiva Loka, you get Vaikuntha at the top of the world egg. So you get reborn in Vaikuntha. Or if you're a Brahmanical follower of Vishnu. But the Shaiva tradition comes along and distinguishes themselves from the Maheshvaras, saying, no, we go beyond those Vaidikas, we go beyond their attainment. Now, the Tantras were an extremely important body of text or revelation that came up in the early medieval period. And the term tantra denotes a text, a system of ritual, and a teaching. So it's an older term, like you get it in the Mimamsakas, but it means system, something like that, or as well as text. So you get tantras of Vishnu, i.e. the Pancharatra Sanghitas. You get tantras to the Shiva, and tantras to the goddess, and tantras to the sun, Surya. And also you get Jain and Buddhist tantras. And you get tantras, a group called Garuda tantras, to the Garuda, the mount on which Vishnu travels, and which are mainly concerned with snake bites and curing people of disease. So, yeah, so you get the only text we have, that we have the Pancharatra Sanghitas have survived. Shaiva tantras have survived, many Shaiva tantras have survived, and the goddess Shakta tantras have survived, but Surya tantras, there's none left of those, they're all gone. And there are some Jain tantras, and the Buddhist tantras, of course, get preserved in the Tibetan tradition, and indeed the Chinese tradition. And there's also a strong antinomian dimension to these tantric traditions, particularly the Kaula sect, but not all, I mean, this is only a minority of the texts. Most of the texts are about ritual and cosmology, temple building. Concerns not that dissimilar from the other mainstream Puranic traditions. And they're concerned with practice, sadhana, initiation, diksha, liberation, power, and pleasure in higher worlds, bhoga or bhukti. So Alexis Sanderson has mapped all of this out, so I would encourage you to read his article, The Shaiva and Tantric Traditions, in Fred Hardy's The Religions of Asia. So the Shaiva Tantra seem to have been the prototype. The earliest ones seem to have been the Shaiva texts. And the Buddhist Tantras, especially the esoteric Yoganatara Tantras, seem to be modelled on Shaiva prototypes. Alexis has argued this and arguably demonstrated it in some of his writings. Now, each of the traditions believe that their texts to be revealed by Vishnu or Shiva, and that these texts were a fulfilment or culmination of the Vedic revelation. So as the Vajrayana in Buddhism considered itself to be the fulfilment of the Mahayana, so the Shaiva tantric traditions regarded themselves as the fulfilment of the Vedic tradition. So perhaps some of this complicated story could be put in the diagram more clearly. Okay, here's worship of Shiva. We get Puranical worship of Shiva. That's the Maheshwaras who follow the Puranas, like Vishnu Purana, Linga Purana. Sorry, not the Vishnu, but the Shiva Purana, the Linga Purana. And then you get the non-Puranika worship of Shiva. And there are two groups here. One group we can call it's called the Pashupatas. And the other, so we're calling the Ati Marga and the Mantra Marga. So, is everyone clear? You've got the worship of Shiva in the early medieval period. There are two groups. There's those who, the orthodox Puranic worship of Shiva, who follow the Vedas as well, but they follow the Puranas in particular. They're called Maheshwaras. And they do orthodox worship of Shiva, offering puja to Shiva, bhakti and puja to Shiva. And they follow Varnashrama Dharma. They follow the orthodox Brahmanical understanding of social order. And that's contrasted with non-Puranika groups which are rising at the time, who define themselves against these Puranic traditions. And there are two groups here. One's called the Atimarga, the higher path. And these are groups called the Pashupatas. Now, Pashupati is a name for Shiva.
There's a temple in Kathmandu that I went to.
What's called the Pashupata? Oh yeah, Pashupata. Yeah. That's the same.
I knew it was a Shiva temple, I just didn't know what Pashupati meant.
Yeah. Pashupati, the Pati, the lord of the Pashus, the beasts or the animals. The lord of animals. And this relates to Pashu, it's a Shaiva theology where the Pashu, all the souls are Pashus. Shiva is the lord of the souls, the lord of the beasts.
The other groups also use the same terms.
Oh yeah, these
groups
use
it.
They
actually use those terms.
Yeah, Pashupati. Yeah, Shiva is just a name for Shiva.
Yeah.
The Puranika groups use Pashupati as well. The Pashupatas were a tradition that became particularly important in medieval India. Very powerful ascetic sect. They called themselves they didn't refer to themselves as the Atimagra, but they called themselves the Atiyashrama, which means the I hear somebody sighing there. The Atiyashrama, which is the fifth ashrama, the fifth stage of life. So you have the four stages of life in the Vedic Puranika tradition. They say, we've got a fifth stage of life, we go beyond the Puranic Vedic orthodoxy, this fifth stage of life, which is the Pashupata Vrata, the Pashupata observance. So,
does that represent the fifth stage?
These thought they had this fifth stage, yeah. This fifth.
Is it just a separation of the sannyasashram kind of thing?
Yeah.
Is it a difference between what being in Varnashram and being an ascetic outside it?
Yeah.
Is that
distinction?
Kind of thing, yeah.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. So they have this observance, this vrata, this vow, which goes beyond the orthodox. They're just trying to separate themselves out from the Brahmanic orthodox.
What did Atiyashrama mean again?
Higher path, higher or outer. This ati means higher, it means outer, the outer path.
The Nats, the Goraknats, do they come in this line?
They're a bit later. They're a bit later.
Okay.
They're coming out of this non-Puranika tradition.
Is it Atiyashrama for what then? Atimagra?
The Atimagra means the outer path. Marga means path.
Mm.
So this is the higher path or the outer path. And they call themselves they follow the Atiyashrama, the outer ashrama, the outer stage of life, the higher stage of life, which is called the fifth stage of life. Do you remember the four stages of life? Brahma, student, householder, hermit, renouncer, and they've got this fifth. So they're trying to separate themselves out from the orthodox. And then you've got this other group called the Mantra Marga, who call themselves the Mantra Marga, the followers of the path of mantras. And they differentiate themselves from the Ati Marga because they saw themselves as even going beyond the Atiyashrama. They thought that they had a higher path than the Atiyashrama. And these were followers of the Tantras. The Tantric revelation, the Mantra Marga follows the Tantric revelation. And the Mantra Marga is itself can be subdivided. This is Sanderson's mapping based on the indigenous Shaiva mappings of these traditions. Into a group, a very important tradition called the Shaiva Siddhanta, which is still very strong in the south. And we'll define it negatively, non-Siddhantika groups. And some of these non-Siddhantika groups are sometimes called Kashmir Shaivas, but that's a bit of a misnomer because they extended beyond Kashmir to the south of India as well. So you've got this very complex kind of mapping of these traditions at this period, to about the 11th century. Now these non-Siddhantika groups were themselves subdivided into various levels and layers. And I'll just give you one name which is important. I'll give you a couple of names. The Trika, the Krama, and the Kaula. Now, all of these groups, if up here then, let's have a mind, if this is Orthodox orthodox adherence to Varnashram and Dharma, you've got a line going right the way down there to the degree of rejection of that orthodoxy. So by the time you get to these Kalma traditions, you've got a complete rejection of the Brahmanical Vedic tradition. And an emphasis on antinomian behaviour. These are probably ascetics living in cremation grounds, rejecting the mainstream tradition and saying we can get liberation of power through antisocial behaviour, if you like, through ritual sex and drinking and
left-hand tantra. The in the Vedas it mentions non-Brahmanic ascetics, which seem to be quite similar externally to some of these later Shaivite groups.
Mm.
This is one historical line that's been traced out by a particular scholar. Yeah? Are there possible that there are other ways of framing this?
Yeah, it is. Mm. There are possible. I mean, this is the Shaiva framing of
yeah.
it. This is this framing from the position of the mantra marker from Abhinavagupta, really. Abhinavagupta's mapped this out. But this is his way of putting down the Atimarga, saying actually we're better than them. And the Atimarga themselves are a way of putting down the Puranikas. But there are certainly other kinds of
things. I mean, is it possible that some of these groups have actually come not in this line, but are actually pre-existing in different forms in another way?
Certainly, saying some of these more extreme traditions could well have been existing before them, but there's no textual evidence for them. But certainly, if we remember the Kashyan hymn in the Rig Veda, the one with the matted locks, he looks very much like a Shaiva ascetic. And then you get a complex process of these more extreme cults becoming re-assimilated back into the mainstream. So the Shaiva Siddhanta then is the normative main, most important tradition today, and it was in the medieval period as well. Sorry, one more word about the Pashupatas. The Pashupatas were ascetic groups, and they became extremely powerful in medieval India. So there's an important temple in Gujarat called Somnath, which was an extremely wealthy temple in Gujarat, which was sacked by Mahmud of Ghazni in about 1020 or something. And there's an interesting book by Romila Thapar published about 2 years ago on Somnath. And those existed in the south of India, they did very well. They were ascetics. They were a bit like the church, I suppose. They attracted lots of funds and didn't spend anything. So they had a lot of wealth and were patronised by kings. And they had an observance of, they worshipped a god called Lakulisha. And Lakuli was a form of Shiva, but also supposed to be a historical figure. Lakulisha was a guru who was said the lord of the Lakula, of the club. And this is there was a talk here a few days ago by Peter Bishop, who's written a very interesting book on early Shaivism, in which he was describing how the Pashupatas have died out, but there's still a cult of Lakulisha being revived in India, in this village in Gujarat now. And they have this observance of various stages of their development. And one of this, first of all, you begin at a temple, living in a temple. And secondly, the second stage of your observance is that you go into the world and you behave as if mad, or you try to attract vilification from others. You make lewd gestures to young women and you pretend that you're lame and you roll around on the ground howling like a dog. Now, why do you do that? You do that, it says, to attract the karma of those who abuse you. So you get their good karma. So if you abuse an ascetic, you get good karma. And the other thing that they would do is the Mahavrata, the great vow. Now, this was a vow for killing a Brahmin. If you killed a Brahmin, according to the Manusmriti, you're supposed to carry his skull for 12 years. So these Pashupatas were actually is a way of saying, look, we're Brahmin killers. You know, we transcend you Orthodox Vaidika lot.
Why did you have to carry your skull for 12 years?
That was a symbol of your sin, the person you murdered. So it's part of this whole net thing of kind of attracting the vilification to attract the karma of those who vilify you.
I didn't quite catch how the Brahmin killing related to the Pashupatas.
Oh, the Pashupatas, they took this vow. There was a punishment, if you like, in the Manusmriti for a Brahmin killer to wander for 12 years with the skull of the person the Brahmin had killed. Now, the Pashupatas take on that vow, although they're not Brahmin killers, but they take on that vow, putting themselves in the position of murderers, really. And it's partly to attract this vilification. And then there's another stage where you meditate on Shiva, Pashupati, and eventually you just pass away in a cremation ground. So they're quite extreme ascetics, some of these, and yet nevertheless a powerful institution.
So, the same as the Aghoris?
The Aghoris are a later development of the same kind of world. Yeah. And the Aghoris are still present, of course, in India.
They're still
there, yeah.
So we need to take care of the corpse until and unless it burns down completely, because then they eat it up.
That's right. in the Pashupata, the text here, the Pashupata Sutra we have, and there's a Kaundinya's commentary on this text. And one of their rituals is supposed to be the corpse ritual, where you're supposed to sit on a corpse, meditate on a corpse. And there's a corpse eating ritual. Now, whether they ever did it or whether it's just a rhetoric.
No, they do. In fact, I've seen that.
Oh, you've seen it?
Oh, yes.
Good heavens.
So, in fact, in Varama, whenever there is a death in the family, there is a lot of tension because somebody has to be deputed to be sitting there until the body burns down, which takes another 7 hours.
Yeah.
So, everybody in the family cannot be there. There is like 2 or 4 people who just stay back to see that the Aghoris don't eat up the dead body.
No, there we are, yes.
They do.
Yes.
That's an extreme tantric behavior in a sense, because that's called Shamshan Jagan.
Oh, indeed, it's very extreme. Now, the Aghoris, they're a modern sect, if you like. But still, this is quite an old tradition, but it's a later medieval period, the Aghoris. But they're a development of these more extreme ascetics. There's another group called the Karpalikas. Who are related to the Pashupatas, and the Aghoris are a development of the Karpalikas, and they do antinomian practices. But it's interesting, Indian middle classes have taken on some of the Aghori, not practices, but gurus. So in Varanasi, Kila Ram is an interesting Aghori guru who many Indian middle classes are devoted to. It's interesting that appropriation of that old tradition. Modernization of it. So he wheezes on his disciples from the balcony. if you're lucky. So read Parry, he's very good on this. Parry wrote a book, Death in Benares.
Something interesting, I've met some of these groups along the board here, and that even though they reject and they could be seen as shamanic, they're some of them actually hold like Kamakanda thread, stemming from the Brahmin traditions, and Brahmin threads of a slightly different kind. They seem to incorporate, I don't know if they just transformed the thread and took it differently, or it's a later inclusion, but
so they see themselves in the Brahmanical tradition.
So this kind of contradiction is not to be seen as a contradiction, because in my family, if I'm a Brahmin, any of my relatives could, when they decide to be a Shaiv, I'm a Vaishnava, and thinking he can decide to be a Shaiv and be a, become a Kapali.
Yeah, but specifically they're talking about Shramanic and non-Shramanic, so in that sense, that's the only way I'm connecting it, because I know practically that these groups, they don't come down to being non-Vedic and Vedic, but in the text, they present themselves like that, even though in reality, they, you know, they don't go around hating each other, you know, in India, you know, they're normally friends or they associate with each other. They, when they talk about Shiva, the Brahmin is talking about Shiva in exactly the same sense. So there's a continuity there, but in the text they present themselves to be.
I think there's a lot of rhetoric in this text. Yeah. You know, we're better than that lot. There's a kind of rhetoric of superiority, if you like. Now, to what extent this same, for example, this mapping here, this Shaiva mapping or Sanderson's reading of the Shaiva mapping, to what extent that reflects social reality is very difficult to say, and it's quite a complex process. Certainly the Pashupatas, although they're renowned for this kind of corpse practice, were nevertheless very respectable and wealthy institution in medieval India with monasteries. So that doesn't square too well with that, those antinomian elements. But why do they do all these things? It's in order to gain power, siddhi.
Power.
Siddhi is the main thing here. Siddhi means power. So they thought they could get magical power through the courting of pollution. Of course, a corpse is the most polluting thing you can get. So if you interact with a corpse in some way, like by devouring it, you're gaining power, siddhi. So the Shaiva Siddhanta then. Well, no, it's just before, we haven't got time to talk about the Shaiva Siddhanta or anything. So just some general. So general features of the tantric of the tantras, really. So the tantras, they're concerned with sadhana, which is practice. Have I got that word? Yeah, sadhana. They're concerned with initiation, which is diksha, in order to achieve liberation, moksha or mukti. And they're also concerned with power, magical power, siddhi, and also pleasure, bhoga, or bhukti, in higher worlds. And there's a common ritual structure you get in these texts of purification of the body, bhuta shuddhi, the purification of the elements in the body, through the symbolic destruction of the elements. So you visualize your body as being pervaded by the universe, and then by mantras, and you symbolically destroy the body from the soles of the feet up to the knees to the thighs to the navel, navel to the heart, heart to the throat, throat to the Madhya to the between the eyebrows and the eyebrows to the top of the head. In your imagination, you destroy the body, or you burn it from the toe of the big foot upwards. The Kala Agni, the fire of time, burns your body in your imagination, and your body is a pile of ashes, and the Bhuta Shuddhi is complete. Then you sweep. There's a flood of water in your imagination, pours out and washes the ashes of your body away, and then you reconstruct your body in imagination, through touching different parts of your body and repeating mantras, so you divinize the body again, because only a god can worship a god in this tradition. And then having constructed a divine body, Divya Deha, you then can worship Shiva or Vishnu in your imagination. And the inner worship, the Manasa Yaga, the mental worship, or the Antara Yaga, the inner worship. And then having performed the inner worship, which is imagining there's one text, the Jayakya Sankhita, which describes Vishnu as Narayana descending through the crown of your head into your heart. You worship Vishnu in your heart, in your imagination, offering him flowers and incense. And then you open your eyes and you do puja to an icon of the deity outside of yourself. So that's your daily practice, really. So all the tantric traditions follow that kind of ritual pattern of daily worship. These were supererogatory rites, so you'd do your Vaidika stuff, and then you'd do all this very time-consuming rituals, so three times of the day, three junctures of the day. And this worship involves the use of hand gestures, mudra, which means seal, and ritual diagrams, mandalas and yantras. And there are very elaborate hierarchical cosmologies in these texts. The universe is seen as like a layers of an onion or something like that, with different levels. And each the later tantric texts add layers, add worlds onto this already complex process. In a sense, to show that their level of attainment transcends that of their previous texts. And that the body also contains a cosmic polarity between a male deity, Shiva, and his female consort or energy, Shakti. And their union within the body is the goal of practice, really. And this is sometimes referred to as the raising of the goddess Kundalini. And she becomes particularly important in later yoga traditions. But she has her origin in these Kaula texts, that's something called the Kubjika Mata Tantra. And lastly, then, some of these texts are concerned with possession and exorcism, which indicates their lower caste origin. They're concerned with what happens if you get ill, i.e. if you get possessed. What happens if you get possessed? What happens if you get ill? And you get mantras for curing you. So there's a text called the Ishana Shiva Guru Deva Padati, a ritual manual, which says, oh, there are 18 kinds of beings that can possess you. And these are the people that's going to these beings possess. You've got to watch out if you're a woman, particularly if you're a woman, if you're pregnant, or if you're laughing, if you're naked, if you're standing at a crossroads, you're very vulnerable to possession by these bhutas that get into you through your shadow, through a chidra, through a hole in your consciousness. And if once they get in, it's difficult to get them out. So. It's interesting. Also, if you're a non-Brahmin, you pretend to be a Brahmin, that you're possessed by a different kind of being. And it's very interesting, the text doesn't make a distinction between the person possessed and the kind of being that's possessing them. But you get rid of them through mantras. Well, actually, it's a very interesting text. It says, first of all, you beat them up. You try and get the being out through beating them. And that doesn't get rid of the being. You say mantras over the creature, and then you nail the tuft of hair. You bring the being out to the tuft of hair in the person's head, and you nail the tuft to a tree trunk, and then you cut the tuft so that the being remains in the tuft, and then you're cured.
Which text is
that? That's a text called the Ishana Shiva Guru Deva Padati. That's the name of the author. Padati is a ritual manual.
That's a recent text, yeah?
No, it's about 11th century.
About
11th century. He was... there's another text called the Soma Shambhu Padati, and it's... There are a whole genre of ritual texts. The Soma Shambhu Padati is translated into French into four volumes by Helen Brunner. And that's a great wealth of material and information. But Ishana Shiva is interesting
should not these texts be studied or analysed, taking in view the Muslim invasion of India at that time? Because sometimes when it appears to be very ludicrous, you know, it wouldn't be, because the kind of symbols that we have lost in time need to be recovered, basically.
Yes. These were mainly in the south, so they didn't seem to pay much attention to the Muslim invasion. But Soma Shambhu is translated to French. The Ishana Shiva Guru Deva Padati is not. There's a PhD there for somebody. So we've got to wind up now. Sorry to keep you. And we'll carry on next week.